It's the Mike O'Mara Show.
Peace be with you.
You guys are stupid.
Why are we stupid? I don't understand.
It's very stupid.
Welcome back to the Mike O'Mara Show. We're very excited about our Fat Daddy Thursday.
Fat Daddy.
Tomorrow we're going to have five fat guys. They're going to be competing for all sorts of wonderful things, and they're going to be out in the parking lot when we play the Mentos Diet Coke Challenge.
Don't we have over a ton of listeners coming down?
Yeah, I keep forgetting what we're giving away on that. I'm trying to remember what it is, but it doesn't really matter. It's $1,000. Oh, my God. How could I have forgotten that?
$1,000.
It's going to be a lot of fun, and we're going to have that all happening tomorrow, along with comedian Jeffrey Ross, who's a very funny guy, and he will also be here on the Mike O'Mara Show.
I'm very excited about Jeffrey Ross.
He's great.
Oh. He is, like, old-school funny, but modern in his delivery. He's hilarious.
Speaking of great, here's another guy who's great. Let's welcome right now a wonderful author, H.D. Bissinger, Buzz, the same name as you, Buzz Bissinger. How are you, Buzz?
I'm good. How are you guys?
Thanks so much for coming on the show. We really appreciate it.
Yeah. Boy, tomorrow sounds like fun.
Oh, we love it. You know, I'll tell you, here's the deal. I'll give it to you in a nutshell. You know, I'm fat, and we play games with fat people. We do that a lot on the show. Just kindred spirits, even though I'm trying to lose weight. You know, it's what we do. It's what we do in this business of show. You can understand that. You've been around show business a little bit, haven't you?
I have.
There's so many things I want to ask you about, but the real thing I'd like to get down to is this whole thing with when you were on Costas Now and you were talking about blogs, and it's funny because you're talking about sports blogs and how you think a lot that's on there is dumbing us down, which I totally agree with, and one thing that we deal with in the radio business, I really think that there is more blogging that goes on about radio programs, radio personalities, radio personalities' children, and their kids. And it is. I have two attitudes about this, Buzz. One is it comes with the territory. It's what we deal with now. But the other thing is, yes, it is dumbing people down. And it is a spirit of meanness that you haven't seen for quite some time. And it's cowardice also. And you know, I kind of love the fact that you were able to go off on this guy. I don't even remember the name of his blog, but I really enjoyed that when you were talking to him, because I think it's gotten a little out of hand on the blogosphere.
Well, I mean, I think it has. I mean, I have to say that as I look back at my appearance on Costas, it was something of a psychotic break.
I'm not going to beat you up on that, because
my wife was ready to put me in a sanitarium.
Really? Wow.
I love it. It's refreshing because he was full of ass.
Well, he was. Well, you know, I just felt he was.
He was. Yeah. And, you know, and every now and then when a snarky guy like that, you know, gets on and he's being his snarky, you know, human being self that he likes to be, you know, the fact is, it was refreshing, and I think that's you probably got that vibe from the audience a little bit. I think at first they were shocked, but then they kind of backed you in the end, don't you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think the audience was with me, and, you know, being a human being, that kind of pumped me up more. And look, you know, in hindsight, should I have used the S word, and should I have come on so strong? I'm not so sure, because it may have subsumed the point I was trying to make. But I'll tell you this, I believe every word of it. Will Leach, up until about this week, was running Deadspin. He's now going to New York Magazine to write. He's a talented guy, but that
he's a smart guy. I mean, he seemed like a smart guy.
That blog, like many, is just dedicated to maliciousness and cruelty and snarkiness and anything goes. And I just don't think it's right. I don't think it's right to do it to radio personalities. I don't think it's right to do it to sports figures. It's one thing. I'm not against the First Amendment, but I'm against profaneness. I'm against ridiculous, profane sexual sophomorism, which most of the comments on Deadspin are. And on many of the blogs, I think many blogs are just terribly written. I mean, people, because of the power of the net, think all you have to do is sit in front of a computer and a keyboard and just type. Well, that's not writing. That's vomiting. And, you know, there are some good blogs out there. I've seen them in the world of sports, particularly blogs that are sort of dedicated to a single source of information. Like, there's one here on the Phillies called the Beer League, or there's one on the Minnesota Timberwolves. They're good blogs, and these are guys who are trying to do a good job. But most of these people are, frankly, it's the American Idol syndrome. They're hoping and praying to get discovered. I mean, blogging has become almost like the sort of hotel coffee shop where Marilyn Monroe was discovered. And they think they're very, very clever and very, very funny. And I got news for them. They're not clever. They're not funny. and they're cowards. And, you know, people
there
think,
you go. Yeah. There, now, there's
Bingo.
The word. You didn't say
well,
it. I was waiting for you to say
well,
that.
They are.
And let me give you the example why I agree with you with this. And you can use the example with email. You won't call someone on the phone when you want to give them certain news, but you'll certainly have no problem emailing
Absolutely.
Them because you are hiding behind the keyboard. That is, and it is the,
right.
the it is the land of the coward. It really is.
And in the case of many of the blog, the blog comments, they're hiding behind fake names.
Right.
You know, people said I acted like the worst kind of blogger, but with one big difference. I wasn't hiding behind anything.
Right.
I mean, everyone knew who I was. Right. I have a website. My email is public. People can say to me whatever they want.
Yeah, when you say sophomoric and also profane, you're talking about this show in many cases when we're screaming at somebody. But, you know, they know where I live. They know where I am. I'm right here. You know, and we're on 5 days a week.
We're not hiding.
If you want to give me a call, you can call and give it right back to
me. Yeah, well, you're not using a pseudonym. I mean, it's the Michael O'Mara show. And they can find you and they can scream back. But I do think that it's part of, look, we live in this celebrity-drenched culture now. And what worries me is that blogs contribute to this culture that I call the culture of disinformation. Bloggers seem very proud of the fact, and they've said this, you know, we don't want information. We don't want to go to the games. I mean, Will Leach said that. I don't want to sit in the press box. We don't care about information. We only care about, you know, spouting off our mouths and our opinions. And, you know, opinions are great when they're well-formed and based on something, but opinions that are based on nothing except your own venting, and when the venting is not very well written, it's not interesting, and it's not funny, and it's not productive.
But, Buzz, you know, you've been around, the sports game for a long time, and
right.
I think you can't confine this to blogs alone. You can also, I've watched, the Rasmussens in Hartford, Connecticut start ESPN, and I've watched it become a great place where you could get highlights all the time, and I've watched the sportscast, which were highlights of games, turn into how quick and how flip and how glib can these anchor guys be? And that's the whole coverage of sports somewhere along the line. I'm not sure where it happened. I'm 48 years old. I've watched this kind of growing up. You saw the sports coverage go from being, here are the highlights, here's what's happening, to, you know, how can I make a snarky little comment about the guy that's out in left field and he makes a good catch? They don't take it, not that you have to revere these guys, but it seems a little bit more... They're trying to be the show.
Right.
I think that's my point.
Yeah,
well,
it's not about them.
I think that's right, and I think there's a reason for it, because they hope that, you know, then they get up their own radio show, and then they get on television, and then they're part of, you know, whatever is the sports writers on ESPN, and I think they have an economic incentive. You're right. Look, you know, I'm 53. I mean, I grew up with Arthur Daly. I grew up with Red Smith. I grew up with W.C. Hines. I mean, these guys were Jimmy Breslin. You know, it wasn't a sports writer, but a great columnist. These guys were great reporters.
Right.
They were great columnists. They were great writers. They weren't afraid. They hit the streets. Now it's who can be the glib, who can be the glibest, who can be the meanest, who can be the snarkiest. And, you know, it's true of bloggers. They never go into the locker room. And it's true of some columnists. They never go into the locker room either. And they're just taking pot shots, trying to draw attention to themselves. And I think ultimately it's just not good for society. And I don't want to, you know, make it sound crazy, but I think we're facing a very dangerous period in our lives. You know, we picked up a book about the movie business in the 1960s, and we forget, you know, everyone was watching the new French wave of movies. They were watching Truffaut and Jean-Luc Godard. And, you know, look at the movies we watch today. I mean, it's insane. You know, everything is sillier and more souped up and hyped up.
No, you can't. You know, you can point fingers at the, you know, at the producers of the movie, you know, what Hollywood's doing with the movies that are coming out of Hollywood, not necessarily at the people that are going to the movies. There's just not, they're not getting the kind of quality that comes out in the movies. And it's just not there. And, you know, I mean, my old man said it before he died. He was talking about the dumbing of America. You know, the fact that we're watering down everything. And, you know, really what sometimes I see as what might be a turning point in this and fight against it will be politics, because suddenly more people are signing up and getting involved in that game. And maybe that'll get people to turn it on a little bit. But it's hard to say. Everything comes quick. Everything comes easy. It's frustrating. I don't want to sound like an old fart when I'm saying this.
No, you're not. I mean, because I think it's true. Everything does come quick now. Everything is easy. Everyone has access. And they think with that access that gives them a lot of power. There's no training. You know, reporting is an art. You know, getting out there and you know, working working the streets and using shoe leather and getting people to talk. That's hard work.
Yeah.
Sitting in front of a computer and just spewing off your mouth at anything that comes into your brain, that's not hard work. That's nothing.
You know, it was interesting that the other night I watched this literally for I watched CNN. And I went between CNN and Fox for about 2 hours.
Right.
It was the funniest thing I've ever seen. You have Hillary and Barack Obama. They're having this meeting. They're having this secret meeting.
Oh, yeah.
And there wasn't a reporter. There wasn't a national reporter or a local reporter or a stringer or anybody who could figure out where the hell they were. And all they did on the network was show a camera phone picture of Hillary's house. And meanwhile, the meeting was going on a mile up the road.
Right.
You know, there really are – people aren't reporting anymore. It doesn't happen. You don't see a lot of reporting anymore.
There's some great, brave reporters out there, particularly the people who cover Iraq, and I have nothing but admiration for them.
Well, it's Richard Engel, right?
I think that's the one. Yeah,
yeah, he's
done
fantastic.
Great work.
Right.
But you're right. But the feeling of newspapers now is, let's make it edgy. Let's make it opinionated. Let's give it a hard edge. Let's make it glib. I mean, what worries me about newspapers is they're kind of caving into the blog mentality. You know, forget just reporting on the game. You know, we got to be a little snarkier. We got to take a punch here and there. You know, we got to do this and do that.
Well, and they'll get an opportunity for that from the reality of the event itself. I mean, I'm a Red Sox fan, and I'm watching the game on the tube the other night, and two of the best, I think, play-by-play color guys, Jerry Remy and Don Arcillo, who do the Red Sox games, they're really, really good guys. And Arcillo comes back and mentions a deal where Manny Ramirez and Kevin Youkilis got into a fight in the dugout.
Right.
And that they really didn't say anything more, and they really can't. They're employed by the ball club. I think they have to be careful.
They do.
And I was just trying to find out what was going on. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's something, as a fan, I want to know, hey, why are these guys butting heads? You don't have to be snarky about it. It's hard to find. I know we go on and on bitching about this, but it is difficult to find in journalism today.
Yeah, no, it is. And I think it's becoming a lost art, and I think that's going to be an incredible, as newspapers fear for their lives and for their extinction in print, which is going to come. I'm just afraid we're going to see more of this kind of off-the-cuff opinion. And as I say, reporting, you know, I became a reporter because of the people in life that I admired, people like Anthony Lucas, who wrote Common Ground, or David Halberstam, who was so great, whether it was writing sports books or books on other serious subjects. You know, this is where I cut my teeth. I grew up with the Pentagon Papers. I grew up with people like Bill Sheehan and the New York Times. You know, but I say, as I said, more and more, it's just about opinion, and there's just so many opinions you can have. At a certain point, you got to get out there, and you got to do, you know, the hard reporting, and I've done it. You know, and I say to bloggers, you know, why don't you get up off your butt and move to Odessa, Texas, and write Friday Night Lights like I did?
You know, nothing
to prevent you from doing it. That's what I did. I quit my
ask
job
you,
and moved out there.
I want to ask you about both that and also the Tony La Russa book, Three Nights in August, when Tony La Russa approached you to write that. I'll go backwards, because we'll go back to Friday Night Lights, because I just have a couple of questions, and I know you get a lot of those about Friday Night Lights. But as far as the Tony La Russa book, he approached you to write this book. I'm curious as to how the genesis of this took place, whether it came down to three nights where you covered the St. Louis Cubs series. How did that all come about? Would Tony just pick up the phone, and was he familiar with your work and said, I want you this way? This
Tony
is incidentally
familiar.
This is my tune of Tony La Russa impression.
He was familiar with my work, and I want to make it clear to listeners. I mean, Tony had no personal economic interest in this at all. Tony is one of the most amazing people I've ever met. He started a nonprofit foundation for the rescue of animals about 20 years ago. He has single-handedly raised, I would say, now close to $20 million. He's built a state-of-the-art facility in Northern California, and he was looking for a way to raise money and said maybe a book is the way to do it.
Okay.
And originally it was going to be, frankly, one of these boring, very self-serving as told to's. But Tony said, I really don't want to do that.
I remember when I came into the minor leagues.
Exactly
it was
right.
A very difficult
time.
And
you know, Tony batted about 120 in the majors, so there wasn't a hell of a lot to say.
Mm-hmm.
He had won a bat in the National League, and that was a walk, so he has the best line score I've ever seen, 0-0-0-0-0.
Wow.
But as we talked, it was Tony who said, you know, I think it'd be really interesting one day just to take a three-game series, because that's how I manage, from three-game series to three-game series, and just take one great three-game series and dissect the hell out of it. And he was just talking. And I said, Tony, eureka. that's the book, but in order to do it, you got to give me access, and you really have to give me control of the book. You got to let me into the clubhouse. You got to let me in the meetings. You got to make me really, in a sense, a part of the team. And Tony said, "You're in." So I had unprecedented access. I was there when no other reporters were there. So I was able to talk to baseball players when they weren't being, you know, surrounded by reporters asking them, you know, "How'd you feel when you gave up that home run with two outs in the ninth?" Well, how the hell do you think I felt?
And when you write a book like that, Buzz, do you actually you get it all together and do you present it at the, you know, before you're going to, you know, set it out to the printer, do you give it to Tony and say, "Here it is"? Because there's a lot of stuff in there that's pretty incredible.
In this instance, it was in the contract that Tony had the right to see it. And I will say this in all candor, Tony did not change a word of it. And
awesome.
in many cases heightened things that were said. He pulled no punches about certain players. He certainly pulled no punches about himself and the sacrifices he made to be the type of manager he is in terms of what it meant, you know, in terms of what it meant with his family. He doesn't live with his family during the baseball season.
Yeah,
he lives in St. Louis, and they live in California, and he has deep regrets about some things he did. His wife got very sick, and the kids were in shock, and she was in the hospital, and he didn't go home.
Yeah.
And talked a lot about J.D. Drew, and talked a lot about players who he felt just weren't, you know, the typical modern day player who just isn't producing at the level that they can. You're a Red Sox fan. I'm sure you see J.D. Drew and you say, "God, that guy could be magnificent if he cared."
Well, I'll be honest with you.
He doesn't really care.
Yeah, the thing is, your book, it was so significant as far as that transaction when the Red Sox acquired J.D. Drew. You know, his reputation preceded him, and you look at the guy, and, you know, all I had heard, you know, La Russa and J.D., and that came out of your book.
Right.
You know, that La Russa doesn't like J.D. Drew. He doesn't like J.D. You know, this guy doesn't give it 100%. And you see J.D. Drew, and in fairness to J.D. Drew, even if he was giving it 110%, he sure as hell doesn't look like it.
No, he doesn't.
He doesn't look like he gives a rat's ass whether he'd, you know, win the game or lose the game. He's doing okay in Boston now. I think he's settled in there. Maybe he needed a place to settle in. But it's astonishing.
He'll never be the type of player he could be because he just doesn't have that engine. I mean, he could be one of the greatest.
Just on natural talent, right?
I mean, his natural talent was amazing. His college career was amazing. I mean, he's a great fielder. He could steal. I mean, he could be a 40-40 guy. And Tony predicted it to a T when he went to Atlanta. He said, "This guy's going to have a breakout year because it's his free agency year, and he's not a dope, and he's going to sign a huge contract," which he did with the Dodgers. And, you know, his nickname when he was with the Dodgers was Nancy Drew.
Yeah.
Because he was hurt all the time. I think he is settled in with the Red Sox.
Foolish me, I gave credit to Yankee fans for that one. I was at a Yankee series and heard that one. You know better. Of course, you know,
and he's in a good lineup, and, you know, he can be quiet, and there's certainly plenty of people on that Red Sox team who are going to take the limelight. And, you know, but as Tony said, and Tony blames himself, he said, "Look, I'm the manager. My job, maybe my most important aspect of my job, is to figure out how to motivate these guys, and I just couldn't do it with him." And he said the thing about JD and a lot of young modern players, JD's not that young anymore, he can coast at 70% and still be pretty damn good.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, it's interesting to watch him because he is just looking like he's disinterested. I want to get to Friday Night Lights.
Sure.
Were you happy with both the movie and the TV series? Both?
Yeah.
Either or?
I consider myself one of the luckiest people alive when it comes to this stuff.
Right.
Now, I know a lot of writers bitch and moan, and my feeling is, look, if you're that worried, don't sell the rights. I mean, they've paid me very nicely for the movie rights. I get a royalty for each episode. I had much more input into the film. It happened to have been directed by my cousin Pete Berg, so at least he returned my phone calls.
And who's a good actor also?
He's a good actor. Was in Chicago Hope and was in The Last Seduction, which was a wonderful movie.
Mm-hmm.
I thought the movie was terrific. It was different. Books are different from films or different from television shows. The book was much more sociological, and Pete was honest about, look, here's what I can do, here's what I can. I'm not making a documentary. But I felt he captured the essence of the book, which was the unremitting pressure and intensity being placed on these kids.
Was that the biggest surprise for you when you did this book, when you got there?
Yeah, I mean, I knew it was big. I mean, when I saw that stadium for the first time, it seated 19,000 people with an artificial surface field. And remember, this is 1988.
Right.
I said, "Oh my God, this is big time football." But to see
in a tiny little town, it's the whole thing. I mean, it's their whole existence down there.
It is, and just to see the quarterback, Mike Winchell, I mean, that kid carried the weight of the world on his shoulders. Yeah. And to see the team turn on the coach because he lost two games by a single point each.
Frightening.
You know, they put for sale signs in his lawn, and there was a petition to have him fired. And then, worst of all, the way they treated a black running back when he got hurt with just vindictive, nasty racism. I mean, I it was just appalling to me.
Did that book do anything to calm that down a little bit?
It did. And, it did.
You know, and, I mean, well, not necessarily in Texas, but all over the country.
Right.
You know, sadly, I think sports now is more important than ever and more overemphasized than ever at the high school level. Even, you know, down, you go below the high school level. I mean, you've heard, I'm sure, legions of stories about how nuts Little League is.
Oh, yeah.
Gravel teams. And our obsession with sports. But I will give Odessa credit. There was change in Odessa, and people said it was because of the book. And people said, you know, when that book came out, we really hated you, and they did hate me. I mean, they issued death threats against me. I was supposed to go down and do book signings.
Wow.
And I had to cancel them.
But and now they're probably ready to kiss your ass again because the TV series
is such a big hit. The movie and they like the TV series.
Good.
The one X factor is the team has been pretty bad for the past decade, and last year they were good.
Do they say you put a hex on them? Is that what they say now?
Yeah, partly. Well, yeah, in a way. They said what happened was is that because of the book, it no longer became popular to be a Permian Mojo fanatic, the school that I wrote about. You know, you couldn't be nuts anymore. But, you know, when you're successful and you're good, then all the excess comes back. So I hope and pray that they keep it in check, because what happens in Destin now is routine throughout the country. And it's not just football. It could be women's soccer. It could be lacrosse.
Sure.
I mean, my God, it's probably bowling in Nebraska, for all I know.
It's the key gymnastics. It's the key to success. What's next in the pipeline? What do you got working right now?
Well, I'm working on several things, but the most interesting right now, it's a fascinating story that's much deeper and much more complex than I ever thought. I do some screenwriting. I work for NYPD Blue for a year.
Right.
I'm working on a screenplay on the life of Sugar Ray Leonard, who behind that kind of perfect image that he had, that man had a lot of demons.
Oh, awesome.
Oh, no. And I have worked...
Boy, that speaks to our listening area right
and
around
I have
here.
I've worked very closely with Sugar Ray. He's one of the most interesting, most articulate individuals I've ever met.
Oh,
and
wow.
I said, Sugar Ray, look, if we're just going to do the typical Sugar Ray story, forget it, because that's not going to fly. He said, no, I'm ready to tell... my story, and it's the story of you know.
How is he doing physically right now?
He's doing great physically.
Okay.
He looks great. He feels great. He had a pretty serious drinking problem. He had a pretty serious cocaine problem.
Wow.
I mean, he was plagued by a lot of demons, you know, and a lot of it was this image they crafted for him. He was really, I would argue, the first black boxer who crossed over, not into white America necessarily,
right,
but into white corporate America.
Sure, mm-hmm. Sure.
And that's a lot of pressure, and I think he was sort of confused. His wife said, you know, I don't know who you are. Are you Ray, kind of the kind, polite, gentle kid from Wilmington, North Carolina, or are you Sugar Ray, sort of this monster in the ring? So it's an exciting
cool.
It's an exciting project.
Oh,
and
man, you bet it is, man. You don't have to say anything more about that.
Good,
that's
good
awesome
sell.
Well, I look forward to that. Buzz, we really appreciate you coming on the show and talking about so much, and you know, keep going on those shows and speaking your mind. Tell your wife you're not insane, you're not
okay,
ready
good.
To be committed or anything like that, you know.
I'm telling you, she had the commitment papers already.
And when the Sugar Ray thing is ready to hit, please come back on the show. I'd love to talk more
sure.
about it.
I'd love to.
Buzz
thanks,
Bissinger
guys.
Thanks so much for being on the show. Take care of yourself.
Okay, man.
Bye-bye. That guy's got a lot to say, man.
Kind of interesting, isn't he?
Oh, yeah. And, you know, who doesn't love Friday Night Lights?
Yeah.
What a great book, great movie. And, you know, as far as a Red Sox fan, he single-handedly, Tony La Russa kind of effed up J.D. Drew's career.
Yeah.
And then we
yeah.
saw him chewing gum going, yeah, whatever.
Yeah.
And we're like, hey, the guy was right.
Yeah.
What are you going to do?
Yeah.
All right, so that's Buzz Bissinger, author of Friday Night Lights and Three Nights in August and A Good Guy.
Yeah.
And we will come back with more fun and more thrills right after this. You're listening to The Mike O'Mara Show.
It's the Mike O'Mara Show.